Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkarant. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Padma Kaimal. She is at the Department of Art and Art History at Colgate University, and we'll be speaking about a fascinating new work of hers called Opening Kailasanatha, The Temples in Kanchipuram Revealed in Time and Space. Padma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Raj. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, it's a pleasure to see you. And unlike the vast majority of podcast guests, I mean, that may change because the American Academy of Religion is coming up soon. Unlike the vast majority of podcast guests, we've met in person just a few weeks ago, about a month ago at Colgate University, haven't we?
Yes, we have. We shared a meal.
Yeah, we shared a meal. We probably bumped into each other about 17 times at airports.
For those listening, we ended up at the same conference, right?
Yeah. We were Colgate University. Their chapel house was kind enough to invite me out to do some talks, and it was so fascinating and so enriching. Great student body there, but it was one of the few places that wanted the entire gamut from me. They were academic talks, you know, undergrad guest lecturing, and then public talk, and then, you know, a guided meditation for the more spiritual crowd there. So it was a fascinating, fulfilling experience. But we got to meet, we had a meal, and then we both happened to be, I believe, on the same flight off to Madison, Wisconsin for the annual conference on South Asia. Yeah. So that's great. So, fantastic faculty out there. Your book. Okay, so tell us about the genesis. Tell us about the backstory. How did you get involved? How did this rope you in?
that's a nice question. So I went to this temple, this one temple in Kanchipuram in South India, when I was doing my dissertation work in 1984-85. And I went there because I was working on portraiture, and I thought, and some sources had said that some of the figures carved into the temple were portraits of Pallava kings. And I thought, best go check that out. So I went to the temple expecting to look at a few sculptures. And then as soon as I entered, I had the same experience everybody else does, which is that I was suddenly overwhelmed by gorgeous, elaborate, just intense amounts of sculpture and a glorious architectural spire and a beautiful courtyard, a peacefulness because the whole courtyard is enclosed with a maybe 15 foot high surround that is itself embedded with tiny temples all around the interior surface. So it was I was suddenly in this world apart, and that was gorgeous. And I had thought I was going to spend an hour or two at the site, and I spent the entire morning, and then I had to go back, and I just kept returning to it. And then I went home and did my work on portraiture and wrote some other scholarship, but this stayed in my mind. I just couldn't I couldn't get over the complexity of it and the way that it presented itself to me as a puzzle. I love puzzles. And I felt like this is a puzzle. Some really brilliant people put these pieces together, and they did it very carefully. And I would love to figure out what that is. I have a dear friend of mine, Dennis Hudson, who's a scholar in South Asian religions at Smith College, was working on his book on the Vaikuntha Perumal Temple, which is just opposite the Kailasanatha in the same city. And in Dennis's formulation, it was built to have a dialogue with the Kailasanatha Temple 50 years later. So Dennis, I was listening to Dennis's work at conferences, and I said, Dennis, you know, we have to do this for the Kailasanatha too. And we started out collaborating. We gave joint papers at a conference, and then Dennis got sick, and ultimately he succumbed to cancer. And it became clear that if I was going to continue this, I'd have to figure out a way to do it without him. But I was so lucky that I got to start the project with him, and he had some excellent questions and insights that really, really got me going. So then I started thinking about this monument in earnest in the late 90s. And then I realized I really am so overwhelmed here by the number of goddesses. I have to do a few years of reading about goddess worship, because I don't feel like I really have any idea what that was in 8th century South India. And the more I read about that, the more I got distracted by, well, I didn't get distracted, but there was another project that bubbled up. I had to really understand this set of goddess images that were traced to the same city, to Kanchi, a couple hundred years later, 9th or 10th century, this group of large yogini goddesses. And I said, well, okay, if yoginis were that important in Kanchi in the 9th or 10th century, I need to understand that. And then I can understand what role goddesses may have played a couple of centuries earlier at the Kailasanatha. So I got distracted for about 10 years and went off and did the yogini project. And then I was just waiting to come back to this. And I kept circling around it and visiting it and thinking, oh, I could write, I'd outline the book one way, and then I'd outline the book another way. And I can't tell you how many tables of contents I generated around this project. And then I met some colleagues who were French scholars based at Pondicherry, which is not far away from Kanchipuram. And they were fascinated with the Pallavas, and they had written some really exciting stuff about their monuments. And our mutual friend Leslie Orr at Concordia University in Montreal introduced us. And as soon as I started working with them and their deep knowledge about the way inscriptions work on the monument and about what goddesses could have meant to the Pallavas, these folks are Charlotte Schmidt, Emmanuel Francis, and Valerie Gillet. And once I started working with them, and I could be in conversation with people, and we could like walk around the monument together and analyze, then the puzzle started to fit. And then I could write the book.
So many fascinating threads. The idea of the space, the temple, presenting one with a puzzle to be solved, or at least engaged, you know, that so resonates. That feels very similar to how Puranic and epic texts sort of strike me. That there's a structure there. There's a method in the madness. There's something that's being communicated to us somehow. So this puzzle, then, is the book about the puzzle? Is the book a solution to the puzzle? What's the central thrust of your book?
Yes, the book is about the puzzle. The book is about so my approach to looking at a monument like this, it's, you know, over 1,000 years old, from a very different culture that is the past is another culture, as we often say. And this is a really distant from me in time and space. My wonderful Indian family has no more connection to this monument than I do. And so the way I try to understand visual and physical form is to look for patterns. Where are the repeats? Where are the rhythms? And yes, words are really useful, really important. There are words on these buildings. There are some words that have been written about them, but almost none during the Pallava time. So it's a few words on the building, but then it's sculptures and it's towers and it's spaces and it's shadows and blinding light. And how do you start to see those snapping into patterns? And then what could those patterns mean? To step back from the patterns. So starting with the physical and the visual, and then backing up, wider angle, thinking about the verbal. How might the verbal help us understand the physical? And then yes, the puzzle. The key to the puzzle is actually the Puranas. I'm glad you mentioned those.
So I hear.
In my final chapter, I engage the really gorgeous sculptural program around the tall tower at the heart of the monument. And this sculptural program is a series of reliefs of Shiva or the goddess or Vishnu, Ganapati, sitting or acting in Puranic stories. Running underneath these gorgeous sculptures is an also gorgeous line of text, a single line of Sanskrit written in really elegant Granta letters. That is a 12-verse elliptical, mysterious poem about the Pallava king who had this tower built. And when I walked around this monument with Emmanuel Francis, I had him help me understand at exactly what letter the inscriptions would break at each corner in the building, every time it bent around a projecting facet. At what word was it bending, or in the middle of what word was it bending? And that allowed me to map out a correspondence between the texts and the images that was, again, very elegant and mysterious and elliptical, but it became clear that there was a pattern. There was something connecting them. The text is talking about the king in the contemporary times. The images above are talking about the gods long ago in Puranic times. But they would say both talk about destroying monsters at the same place in the monument. Right above the text about destroying monsters, you see Shiva destroy a monster. And a bunch of other little like sutures that made it clear to me there's a connection here. And then puzzled over that for a long time until I came across the work of Dawood Ali, who talks about kingship in all different kinds of texts in South Asian history and meta patterns that he finds across these texts. And, you know, so we're looking at Puranas, we're looking at royal inscriptions, we're looking at praise poems from royal courts, we're looking at devotional literature. He looks at everything and epics, of course, too. And the theme that he finds throughout is a belief that the king or kings are on earth to continue the heroic work of the gods. So what the gods did in Puranic times, kings of their present time were endeavoring to continue. So protection, lineage, producing lineage, keeping down the the competitors consorting with beautiful women, all of these actions that are so important for the gods to be doing in Puranic times, the king is endeavoring to do himself. So the inscription leads you around these Puranic stories and makes a visual connection between what the god is doing up above and what the king is doing in the inscription.
That's so very deeply resonant, both as, you know, a podcast host in Hindu studies, Indian religions, and sort of beholding the intricate interplay between textual traditions and lived traditions and material culture and even what we can infer that might have been preserved in oral memory, that such that we need to now figure out as scholars how to make sense of this. I mean, the interplay is lovely, and also this real interest in Kanchi, and there seems to be a number of studies currently that are looking at this, the temples in this amazing city and how they're structured, but also in particular, it just so happens that my primary work, my doctoral dissertation, the first book, and pretty much the second book, most of the second book, focused on the Devi Mahatmya. And one of the things I show through the narrative structure of the text, looking at the structure of the text and the ring composition, almost as if it was sort of a temple with a central episode and then sort of flanking episodes, is that sovereignty is central to the text, both thematically and structurally. And the goddess is an analog for the king so terrestrial and celestial sphere sort of mirror each other, and so it's about a celebration of this core important dharma of preserving the world. And so in the end, the king gets his kingdom back, and he gets promoted to be a manu, and the merchant gets moksha. And one of the major interventions of the work that I've done is to say, look, it's not that the king is not wise enough to want moksha, and that he's subordinate to the merchant who's seeking moksha. It's actually somewhat subversively, the merchant is subordinated to the king who wants really what the goddess wants, which is the preservation of this realm. So, you know, had I encountered this, I certainly would have, had this work been out at the time I was dissertating, I certainly would have included a footnote or a paragraph. Could you tell us a little bit, just for my selfish purposes, if nothing else, about the role of the Devi Mahatmya that you've encountered in this temple?
I would be delighted. So the Devi Mahatmya is embedded in reliefs in three different ways at the monument. And it took me an embarrassing amount of time to realize that the goddess herself, the embodiment of triumph, the goddess of the Devi Mahatmya, is in fact one of the emblematic royal figures on that monument, that she's as much a stand-in or a focus of emulation for the king as any of the figures of Shiva. And she is especially resplendent in these reliefs, where she's standing with one of her feet resting on her lion's shoulder and all of her weapons arrayed around her in a beautiful oval, and just confident and relaxed as can be, just kind of one elbow leaning on her thigh, like, yeah, I did that. I dispatched all those guys.
It's play.
Bring it on. Yeah, she's spectacular. And then there are two other small reliefs that tell stories from within the Devi Mahatmya. One is the her pursuit of Shumba or Nishumba, one of those two brothers. And then there's one where she's appearing, not really, she's disembodied as Yoganidra, and she is the sleep of Vishnu. So we see Vishnu reclining, and Madhu and Kaitaba, the two demonic forces who are coming to destroy the world while Vishnu sleeps. But she is the one who galvanizes Vishnu's weapons into personifications who then accost Madhu and Kaitava and dispose of them. So we have her in those three different forms. And if we're walking in a clockwise way around the monument in normal pradakshina, as all householders, people in householder phase of life, like the king in Devi Mahatmya would do, we would see those two small episodes first. And then at the end, we see her as a large figure with the weapons, with her foot resting on the lion and no demons. And there's been a lot of ink spilled in the scholarly world about why there's no Mahisha. Why is there no buffalo-headed demon that the goddess kills in a climactic, perhaps you would say the central episode of the Devi Mahatmya? That's such a common sculptural theme. Why isn't that? Why? Where is the demon? Where's Mahisha? My way of solving that is to say this is actually the last hymn of the Devi Mahatmya, where she transcends time. She transcends episodes.
The Shakaradi Stuti. No, sorry, the Narayani Stuti. The hymn of chapter 11.
Thank you. Yes. So here she isn't embedded in any narrative. She has transcended narrative, and she is simply an embodiment of Shakti, of triumph, a resplendent, and outside of time. So she doesn't. So putting a Mahisha in there would limit her. It would anchor her to that one story. And here, she's beyond that.
She's done. This isn't the moment. This isn't the moment of slaughter, the moment of... she's done. The demons are destroyed, right?
Yes.
So remind me again, the Yoga Nidra vignette is the first one that we see visually, correct?
No, actually, it would be the second.
And the first one was...
Shumba, Nishumba. I think it's Nishumba, because there's this ropey bouncy thing in her on her head that I think are the entrails of Shumba that she wraps in her hair before she chases Nishumba.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. So let's pan out a bit. Tell us a bit about the structure of the book.
So the structure of the book is each chapter is a different pattern that I see, and they're spatial patterns. So we start out thinking about the majority of the sculptures. Majority of the sculptures either face north or face south. And there's a very strong pattern amongst those figures, and that there are almost no figures that face both directions. And all of the figures that do face in a single direction have something in common with each other. All of the ones that face north are in a state of ascetic, intense power. So they're fighting demons. They are embodying triumph. This gorgeous goddess faces north. they are locked in intense meditation and destroying other, controlling others and themselves. They are single figures in the center of a composition. They are accompanied by only other figures of the same sex. And they interact with those other figures through domination, if they're the god. So domination and subordination. Whereas all the figures facing south are in some kind of interaction that happens not quite equally, but almost equally. The two figures on either side of a composition and the center of the composition is left open as a space of interaction. And these figures are interacting in various ways that signal forms of continuity. So the Shiva is flirting with the goddess, or he's flirting with the wives of the sages in the pine forest. Shiva is teaching others in his lineage like a guru, and he's being followed by princes and sages and wild animals. Or he is teaching Brahma and Vishnu that he is superior to them, using the Lingodbhava story where Shiva appears in an eternal flaming pillar or linga, and neither Vishnu nor Brahma can find the top or the bottom of the flaming linga, and they therefore realize that Shiva is much bigger than they are, than beyond their ability to encompass or comprehend. So south-facing images are about continuity, nurture, interaction, and the kinds of continuity that are about generations and generations of humans, or the giving birth to each other, or gurus teaching students, teaching students, teaching students. Whereas those facing north are in a kind of ascetic resplendence, and they embody that form of power that the body can control when one is ascetic.
Fascinating.
So that's the chapter. That's one pattern, and it's on all of the buildings. It dictates the sculptures on all of the buildings, and the next chapter is about sculptures that face east and west. And those sculptures tell the story of lineage continuity in Shiva's family and in the royal family, how fathers beget sons, with how Shiva and the goddess have baby Skanda, and Skanda grows up and he gets married, and so this is sense of continual regeneration that produces a great long lineage. Then there are frequent parallels in the east-west facing images between Shiva's family and the Pallava family. But we see a really interesting shift, that nobody compares themselves or their king. Nobody compares themselves to Shiva. Kings are compared to Skanda, and their departed fathers are Shiva. So there's and then when Skanda grows up and passes on the kingdom to his son makes his father into a Shiva, and the son becomes the new Skanda. So we see this sense of patterns repeating in this endless cycle, to convey that the Pallava lineage would continue forever. Although, of course, it did exactly the reverse. The kings engaged with this monument are the last kings of their branch of the Pallava family.
That's a really fascinating motif of invoking the symbology of Skanda versus Shiva. You know, the general of the army of the gods, you know, virile, you know, Rajas, you know, yeah, this is the current king. And then Shiva is either the god of destruction / transformation, or an ascetic, or, you know, he's left the scene, you know. So yeah, here you go.
He's in historic Puranic time, and Skanda is right here. Skanda is right here on Earth, and he is your king.
It's fascinating. I mean, clearly you've been fascinated by this temple for a long time, and so what has maybe shifted for you in doing this work in your perspective, or was there anything that particularly surprised you, or you know, what's without asking too leading a question, you know, what stayed with you about this puzzle, or the way you've solved it?
So what really stays with me is what is now in the last chapter, where I'm trying to figure out why are the sculptures and the text wrapping around it connected? What's the point? What is the story being told here? And also, why is this text, it's a single line of text, that so you, in order to read it, you have to follow it. Why is it wrapping around the monument in a counterclockwise direction? Because we're not supposed to walk that way, are we? And when we do that, other people at the monument get very upset. If you go to a Hindu temple now with your family, everybody insists you have to walk in a clockwise direction. So that part really stayed with me. And I would give lectures at workshops and take my colleagues around talking about what the monument, what this inscription said. And then the devout Hindus in the group would then have to retrace our steps. They have to reverse our steps and go around the monument 3 or 5 or 7 times in a clockwise direction, because just walking counterclockwise felt so wrong to them.
Inauspicious. So,
yes, but what does inauspicious mean, right? I feel like inauspicious is a very poor English word to do the work. What is it? Well, it doesn't mean just unlucky. It means it's not about polarity. It's not like good and bad. It's about the kind of ascetic energy that we see in the figures who face north. It's about a kind of power that is undoing, that is ending things, that is aiming towards moksha, transcendence, and along the way to that, death, the end of this present form one happens to be in. And then you can understand why your auntie does not want you walking that direction. But that it's that very movement that is so powerful and in the building's plans. And so I step back and I realize chapter 4 is about how the entire monument is set up to equally encourage clockwise and counterclockwise movement, and to keep those two forms of movement in a kind of dialogue with each other, because the Pallava king wants to embody both kinds of energy. He wants to be both a magically powerful ascetic and a virile king of this world. And so, you know, he could walk either way, depending on where he is that day. But we know from the inscription that was counterclockwise that he took initiation into a tantric sect. So
That's exactly what I was going to ask you about, the presence of tantra and tantric traditions, where what may be considered inauspicious from an orthodox perspective might be precisely what is required for yielding the utmost power or siddhi or goal.
So, oh, I'm so glad that's where your brain went with it. That's exactly what I was hoping was true.
And I don't, you know, clearly I don't have the nuts and bolts. I don't have your fine training. I know very little about this other than what I've read for the podcast. But to my mind, it really feels to me like, you know, for example, the Devi Mahatmya. I mean, the only way to see it in order is if you go counterclockwise, but you see it the episodes backwards if you go clockwise. You know, does that bespeak, you know, it could be my either scholarly or mythic imagination at work, but does that bespeak a tantric tradition of veneration for the Devi, where that from the perspective of tantra, do you rightly see the order of the Devi Mahatmya, pun intended? And the other idea that comes to mind, the other idea that comes to mind is in some ways, Does the temple not, isn't it not reminiscent of the churning of the ocean of the devas and the asuras?
And they're moving.
They're moving in opposite directions, and they have to clockwise and counterclockwise, clockwise and counterclockwise, and somehow the temple has the wisdom to incorporate the totality of that philosophically, but probably also because the tantra was so in vogue that they were aware that there were orthodox traditions and heterodox traditions, and from a tantric perspective. So, anyhow, enough of my random conjecture for one day.
No, I think that's a lovely suggestion. I like that parallel. And we do see several places on the monument where we have this interesting kind of slippage between Shaiva and Vaishnava, between something that Shiva is doing in on the monument and something that Vishnu does in the text. So there's, and again, I go to Dawood Ali's work, who says, and where he says that that even kings whose Ishta Devata, whose primary devotion is to Shiva, understand themselves to be Vishnus in the way that they're skandhas, that in this world they act like Vishnu, even though Shiva is their favorite deity. So, and we see this place on the monument where the inscription is talking, clearly alluding to Vishnu rescuing Bhudevi from the bottom of the ocean. And the text above shows Shiva doing something, sorry, the image above shows Shiva doing something comparable.
That makes so much sense to me, insofar as the king, the king is meant to do the work of preservation, right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Which is the work, which then Vishnu and the goddess both, bar none, their roles are roles of preservation.
And there's a meta level of preservation that the inscription claims for the king here. It's not just that he's keeping his kingdom okay. It's that by reuniting all the kingdoms of the world, he has ended the Kali Yuga and brought us full cycle into a new Krita Yuga, a new utopic time of unity and harmony and people living forever and everything being wonderful. So he has actually controlled time. He's boom, ended an eon.
Fascinating. Let me ask you this question that I almost always ask on the podcast. What sorts of readers, scholars, what interests would this book serve? Who might most be interested in this book?
Well, I always try to write for my mom. I always aim my prose at really smart, interested people who haven't read anything that I've read. So, and my mom liked the book, so I felt like I might be there. So my mother is a very, very smart woman who grew up in the 40s and 50s and, went first in her generation to go to college. And what was she told to major in? Home economics. But she has this brain for literature and visual arts. And she spent her whole life filling in all of that stuff that she needed. And so she said, yeah, I get this book. I like this book. I do love to write for a general, curious person. But specifically, who am I talking to here? I'm talking to folks like you, people who understand South Asian religion, and I hope more ways than I do. And you'll take this and you'll do something with it that I wouldn't be able to do. I'm also, of course, aiming at the community of art historians who study temples, and encouraging all my colleagues to see these monuments in kind of dynamic ways, so that we're constantly engaging with the physicality of the thing. A building isn't a book. So we're not about, where are we going to find the manuscripts that would explain this temple to us? If people wanted to write books, they wrote books. If they built a temple, it's because a temple can do things a book doesn't do. It's much harder to build a temple than it is to write a book. I can say that because I've written a couple books and they were hard, but building a temple would be much more difficult indeed. So I'm speaking to art historians for sure. Those are my people. That's my inside community. But I do hope people who study religion and who, and anybody who just wants to think about how a building could carry meaning, could transform you, will find it interesting.
Fantastic. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, Raj. It's just a joy to talk about it, and especially to talk about it with someone who understands this stuff so well.
Or at least pretends to, but you're welcome. Shh, don't tell my listeners. Right, for those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Padma Kaimal on fascinating new publication called Opening Kailasanatha, The Temple in Kanchipuram Revealed in Time and Space. Keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the interplay between temples and texts. Take care.